But today I think we've got a very interesting subject. I have to declare an interest. I was at a conference 2 years ago in Morocco, and I really, being ill-educated, had never heard much about the Sahel. One of the speakers was the just-retired head of Nigerian intelligence, who I thought was going to speak to us about Nigeria. He didn't. He spoke to us for an hour about the Sahel. At the end of that talk, my hair, and I think most other people's hair, was standing on end. And it was an area that I think had been missed by the West, an area where a lot of things which were happening which were of great significance to the West. And when I came back, I began to ask questions about it and push a little on it. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought we ought to try and find a focus to make people look at it. Since then, of course, we've had the problems in Mali. We've had the incidents of Gaddafi's arms going south of the Libyan border to support certain of the less salubrious groups in the Sahel. And I think it's a higher profile. And what I wanted to do today was to get to speak to us someone who has special responsibility within the government for this particular question. Stephen O'Brien was appointed last September to be the special representative for the Sahel at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Before that, he was the Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State for International Development, and he is the MP for Edisbury. I'm not going to embarrass him by reading out the rest of what is a very distinguished CV, except to say that before he came into Parliament, he was the International Director and Company Secretary of Redland PLC. So he has experience in the private sector as well as in government. I'm delighted that he's agreed to come and talk to us today. The title is The Sahel, Terror Averted or Just Postponed. Stephen.
Well, Michael, thank you very much indeed. And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's an enormous pleasure to be with you this afternoon. And I am very pleased to have this opportunity to share with you some of the experience and the questions and thoughts that are provoked by what has been emerging as a subject that people increasingly get to know about called the Sahel. I'm delighted to be able to accept Michael's invitation and do congratulate him on the progress of the Global Strategy Forum and having such a significant impact on thinking around the globe on these key issues over the years that he's been so focused on it. And particularly for Michael, as he was the chairman of the Conservative Party when my by-election happened, and he was the one who made the fateful phone call on a Friday night. I was the candidate by Tuesday and the MP 3 weeks later. So he has a lot to answer for. But his commitment to peace and security is absolutely total. And also, it's interesting, given that we're talking about the potential for understanding how you deal with a terror threat in a particular part of the world and what drives that, that I think that everybody in this audience, from wherever they come, have all, whether we're in the UK or abroad, had our lives in some way affected by terrorism. It is one of the challenges of our generation, both as politicians and as people. And I'm particularly touched that Sir Jeremy Greenstock, I happen to catch, is in the audience because he was at the UN UK mission at the time when I was one of the parliamentary representatives from here to go and lay a wreath just a few weeks after the terrible events of 9/11 at Ground Zero. So, as I say, we've all been affected terribly by terror. But let me just try to set the scene a little bit. And that is that the Sahel, which is this band, starting really from Mauritania and affecting 9 countries, but not including almost all of them, as it were, and it sort of reaches through Chad and on to Eritrea. But really what we're focused on are those countries situated in the north and west of the African continent. And I came to know about the area because as I left Cambridge University with a couple of friends and in an old Desert Rat radio repair lorry, we went on an expedition across the Sahara and the Sahel, back and forth, collecting mosquitoes, as you do for malaria research. And I came to know the beauty, the grandeur, the enormous distances of that series of deserts and marginal life land. And it was something which has stayed with me. And not only did that lead to all the malaria campaigning, rather than the fact I was born on the east coast of Africa, give me this interest. But I came to realise how we, the West, had, for our 200 or 300 years in the command of the seas, been focused totally on the littoral of Africa. Whereas for millennia, people have been crisscrossing west, east, north, south, across these deserts, which we regard as natural barriers, and had never been regarded as such by those who are part of that very, very large desert landscape. And it's extraordinary. It's a series of mountains, of corrugated crust, of dunes. It's very difficult terrain to get around. We tend to try and do it on wheels or tracks. Those who know what they're doing tend to go on hooves or feet. And it's very important to recognise that has an effect on why the ability for this to be remote, cut off, not particularly understood by the traditional Western nations, has actually been part of what has led to the challenge that we've all faced recently. And Mali, for instance, right in the middle of the Sahel, in that part of North and West Africa, with no sea, no coastal boundary, is twice the size of France, more or less. In the northern half, there's a thinner neck, and then the southern half. In the southern half, about 90% of the population live, and in the northern half, about 10% of the population. More or less split between what is traditionally known as the white Arab as against the black central and south part of Africa. But I'm going to hasten to add that as the narrative of what took place, and from that the issues that will surface, one of the things that which did not seem to drive the terror threat that emerged in the Sahel is not, as some people would claim, been a racist issue. There doesn't seem to be the evidence that it has been effectively a North African series of people versus a Central and Southern African series of people, or between the old traditional form of rather tolerant Islamic faith-based traditions in the north versus the more Christian-based, recently animist traditions in the central and south. And I think that's important to recognise, in the same way as we have to recognise that Timbuktu, for instance, was twice in history, I'm told, I haven't seen the proof, twice in history, the highest per capita income in the world. No accident, because of the marvellous amounts of commodities of great high value transcrossing the desert regions. And so, with that challenge of us, if you like, being very focused, and indeed, if you like, the UK interest, always an important aspect of why we should be engaged in this area at all, our equities, if you like, are in Nigeria, Ghana, Sierra Leone, relationships with Morocco, Algeria, Libya more recently, and of course from the past, and many others besides, but each one of those with a coast. The areas we've been talking about across the Sahel are broadly in the Francophone sphere in terms of historical connection. And of course it's pretty useful to speak French when you're travelling around the area, but actually the issue has not been that there was a strong relationship, however connected they are with France. It's because the way that France had their relationship with those Sahelian countries was, I have to say, an extremely different model to the one that, for instance, the British had with their relationship countries in Africa. It was more, if you think about it, in the desert areas, they would have forts, and they'd go out and they'd sort of make relationships and come back, whereas a more administrative approach on the littoral states, the old British model, I say that with some authority, as my 81-year-old father, who was one of the very last, if not the last, district officer appointed in the old colonial service, went off to Mtwara in East Africa, hence I was born there, he would argue that they were much more organically, from the bottom up, trying to forge relationships with communities and have an administrative control that way. And this has actually lasted, and I will, as it were, come back to this point, but I think it will be important for us to understand the continuing threat and opportunity in the Sahel region is how much the French model of that sort of top-down, dirigiste approach to administration and political engagement and control is actually one which is going to help re-engage what is felt to be a totally disenfranchised north of Mali. People who don't feel, often Tuareg-based tribes, associated with the Bamako-based 90% of the population, where both the power elite, totally encapsulating all the vested interests, live, or whether more of an organic approach is going to be part of the way we think forwards to try and counter what has become the opportunity for terrorists to take advantage of areas which have become disengaged and relying on incomes which are either informal or corrupt or criminal. So, what actually happened in the Sahel, as it happens, we know that quite a lot of cash was being raised through the kidnap for ransom. Commercial model, if you can put it so bluntly. It was a successful model, and I was absolutely thrilled that the G8 made the announcement as they did, that governments at least were now totally committed to not pay on kidnap for ransom. But as we know, as was stated in the G8 communique, about $70 million had flowed to Al-Qaeda in the last 3 years, of which 33 was in the coffers of Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb. So that gave you a capacity to be able to take action in their interests. And this was not, I hasten to add, as we more recently came to understand the Sahel challenges, this was not, in my opinion, and I think it's well supported, a function of the Arab Spring. There are many interpretations of that across the north coast of Africa, and whilst there were obviously some connections, many would argue that that was also at least one of the issues, I should say, was male youth unemployment driving a lot of that disenchantment. Well, of course, you could say that's equally applicable to the Sahel, except we're not dealing with intense populations. These are very high, mobile, travelling, many Bedouin populations, where the normal form of jobs, as we would see them, doesn't really apply. This is to do with moving to both pastoral areas, but let's not forget that if you take, for instance, the very well-researched UNODP statistics, where they now have maps on the internet, you can see it, it's published, where the former head of the French Judicial Police is heading up the UNODP based in Dakar, Senegal. He has, on evidence, shown the arrows of all the criminal flows of people trafficking, of oil, sugar, salts, other medicines, counterfeit medicines, obviously narcotics of various types, flowing, as they always have done, partly up the west coast of Africa, partly often sourced at sort of Nouakchott and the Mauritania end, and coming right across and flowing up through parts of, traditionally into the western high purchasing power markets of Europe, through Morocco and Algeria, but now far more widely getting across, many coming out through Tripoli in the areas of the Libyan coast, and also not just coming into Europe, going into the Middle East as well. And it's on the back of those flows and all the traditional crisscrossing of this area by people who know what they're doing that they were able to find that this was their form of income, but one which was resented and not counted and certainly informal. As a result of which, there was this disengagement between the structures under sovereign jurisdictions, whether it's the Bamako government or the government in Niamey, a long way south for the rest of Niger, another huge country which has been very fragile. And as a result of which, those with ill intent, Al-Qaeda of the Islamic Maghreb, were able to say, we've got a lot of people who are very unhappy, and we can go and become an area which we can effectively occupy. We can be somebody who can land in the area of this deep disengagement. So that was, if you like, where the cause came from. But the political cause that lay behind it was that a number of the Tuaregs wanted their independent state of Azawad, a fundamentalist Islamic state. This was a call for independence. Poverty, of course, drives so much of people's sense of disengagement and disappointment in their leaders or whatever. And so, as a result of that, there was a significant feeling that the Sahel would attract not just Al-Qaeda, but others who had come from southern Algeria, and of course there was evidence that many of the people in northern Mali were not Malians. They were from traditional insurrectionists from southern Algeria, from many parts across what is known as the arc of insecurity, which the G8 identified, from Mauritania, right the way across beyond the African continent. As a result of which, I found myself, as the Minister for International Development, having to look at it from a donor point of view, because we had a massive humanitarian crisis in the Sahel. We, in deciding we had to be much more limited in how we applied our aid, had pulled out of Niger. But actually, when we looked at our strategy of putting money where the most need was, it became absolutely clear to me that we had to go and address the 20 million people at risk of starvation in and across the Sahel, mainly the southern part of it. That we did, and £58 million from the UK aid budget went that way. The Europeans stepped up in a big way. But it became clear, and this is going back to sort of late 11, early 12, it became clear nobody had access to northern Mali. Now that is a clue which is pretty powerful. And then we had the coup in March. Remember, we'd had a coup back in about a year, 18 months earlier in Niger, so there was a lot of instability in the area, but then there were these interim governments. And I found myself in July 2012 at the National Security Council arguing that we should take a much more fundamental look at the threat posed by what was going on in Sahel, and it affected UK interests because the longer we left unaddressed these sources of instability, the more likely it was that we were going to find insecurity on the southern geography of Europe. As it happens, there was then the French election, and there was a change of president, and in the first conversation between our Prime Minister and President Hollande, in answer to the question, you know, what's your priority, Mr. President, in foreign policy, he said it's Mali, Mali, and Mali. And the Prime Minister said, well, I've only ever heard that word from one person in my government, so I'm going to have to do something about that. So that's how I came to be in the job I'm in. And so my job was very simple. We will support our French ally. We must do everything we can to deal with any genuine existential threat to our security and the capacity for that security. And we should also be prepared to rely on the experience we've had from the past, whether it's in Afghanistan, Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia. In other words, at a political level, if something happens that's dreadful, a terrorist attack, to people like me who have constituents to answer to on every Friday, you've got the proof, if you like, of the terror that you're going to address. How do you actually then demonstrate that the UK should be engaged in something before it happens? And that's a much more difficult political case to make. But this was an area where, in particular, the French, who had been discussing it at the UN, had decided that this was of a real threat. The UN, I have to say, was absolutely brilliant as we sought to negotiate. There were a series of resolutions in July 2012, then in October, and as you know, December last year, and then April. But it was because we were only discussing on a genuinely development, governance, and security approach, as you should at the UN, the three-legged stool that has to stand in order for you to have a strategy. It was only because we were looking at military preparedness, trying to have an African-led solution that would actually mean that there was this combined collective view against the force of terrorism, where there had been an accusation, which is somewhat supported by the evidence, that Wahhabist tendencies had started to infiltrate what had been a more tolerant Sufist tradition in that part of Africa, to the point where there was a need to be both military ready and to try and get the AU and as well as the regional organisation ECOWAS engaged. Of course there was a capacity problem in ECOWAS. There's always been a capacity problem in agreement. If you were a business, which of course quite rightly sovereign countries are not, you would look at the north and west of Africa and you'd say this is ripe for a series of takeovers because these are not capable economically of standing alone. But that is not the way you can deal with countries, whereas they were looking to have a more cooperating, coordinating approach through ECOWAS, but that was really undercapacitated. And there was also a sense that it was Abuja-centric rather than regionally focused. The AU was finding it quite difficult to be as strongly engaged in this part of the world as perhaps it's taken the lead in other parts of Africa. And so, as a result of which, it became clear, not least because, of course, the only way we could engage Morocco, which is neither a member of ECOWAS nor the AU for reasons well known, so we had to engage them through the UN. And as a result of which, the UN found itself being both the mandator, the authority, the legitimizer, and the people taking the action. And that was absolutely right as we moved trying to make it an African-led military preparedness force, a FISMA, as it was known, which was sort of coming together, but it had to transmogrify into MINUSMA, which is the current force trying to keep the peace. And now we've gone beyond December and January. We were at that point of trying to look really to about now. We were thinking October 13 is roughly when we need to be ready, after the rains, when it's too hot for anybody to think of starting to fight. And then, of course, Al-Qaeda were looking at all the stuff that we were looking at, and they could see what the world was doing in terms of getting ready, and they thought, well, why should we wait around to get hit? So they started moving in January, and of course at that point the person who led the original coup, Captain Sanogo, who was in the Kati barracks just outside Bamako, back in March 12, he started coming out of his barracks. And so it was quite clear. The intelligence was, as was published, the Al-Qaeda and Mujal, this other terrorist element, which was more locally hired, as it were, and Ansar Dine, with a charismatic local leader. And rather regrettably, at the last minute, the original Azawad independence movement, MNLA, somewhat Tuareg-based, also threw its lot in with that collection of people, not just from Kadal, where they are based, up in the northern mountains near Algeria, but also with Timbuktu and Gao and the areas that the Al-Qaeda and Mujal had somewhat commandeered, which had been welcomed initially by the local people because in the disengagement they'd had from their own government, they didn't welcome Sharia law until too many of them were finding it was actually rather too rigorous. And they were very happy to have, as we know from elsewhere in the world, the basic services delivered by Al-Qaeda, which they had absolutely never received from their own government and been supported. So that had won their hearts and minds. And so that's how they were able to garner the support to then get on the road down to Mopti. It was at that point, and one has to broadly calculate it, there was about 3 hours to go before it looked as though the Bamako government, the interim government, would fall. And so the French acted, and they were ready. They were able to do the surge from their forces, which are stationed in other parts of Africa. And it was at that point, because of the unusual approach, indeed, there have been prime minister envoys, but never for a sort of area and a cause. It's been for thematic reasons in our government. I've been rattling around Whitehall with no budget, but trying to get everybody to understand basically the problem and what assets collectively we need to bring to have options, to help allies, to make sure, in addition to aid, we were pushing good governance, legitimising through elections the governments locally, and pushing on the regional structures, engaging with the UN as a responsible member of that body in the Security Council, and engaging as many people as we could across Africa, and of course working very closely with our principal equity interest, if you like, in Nigeria, who have a big influence in that part of the world. And so when President Hollande said at a weekend, we've had to marshal about 4,000 troops, we're going in, we've got to the invitation of the Malian government, the Malian army has not been able to do anything to repel this advance, and we were able immediately to supply some logistical support. I know that the Secretary of State Defence was well prepared with two C-17s, and with our Sentinel-R intelligence gathering airborne asset, as well as some roll-on, roll-off ferry transportation and other intelligence sharing. So that was a useful, very quick response. That encouraged lots of others, and you had a much more collective effort. But I think we must salute the approach the French took in a way which raises questions about, is a military solution the right answer? Well, against the sort of advance we had in Mali, which is absolutely the apex, an episode within the broader Sahelian challenge, which we all face and continues, both as a result of poverty, lack of development, intense population growth, a lack of resources to support that, and desertification, partly caused through an overuse of assets, what assets there are to eat and to try and build economies, as well as global climate change. So as a result of that, the French led this effort. Interestingly, the key response in terms of military support came from a non-ECOWAS member, Chad, who did a remarkable job as part of the Operation Serval, as it was called. And all the time, we had the UN looking at this. As you know, this was a unified response. There were no vetoes. There were no difficult discussions. Going back to 19th of October last year, I found myself sitting next to the Russian ambassador, the representative on that occasion in Bamako, as we were discussing these things. So this was very much a United Nations approach to an area which had not yet had a terrorist incident, but suddenly was faced with a known Al-Qaeda terrorism threat, trying to get, for the first time, a total state as a safe haven, close to the soft underbelly of Europe. And before, and we still pray, before bombs went off in Marseille or Paris or London. And so that was why this was different. I think it's dangerous to make too much of an equivalence between other areas which have had a lot of focus. But also one of the reasons we haven't heard a lot about it recently is because the success of Operation Serval, and I pay tribute, has been that it has given a new platform for legitimacy. We've had the inauguration of IBK, the new president. We have legislative elections in Mali coming along. We have a recognition that it is right that the UK, along now with the US, because there's an elected president, gives them a legitimate government, which gives them a better conversation with Congress to be able to support the aid effort. And because we've got Mali in a place where it is back in the context of the total Sahel. The danger is we move off and say job done, when in fact all the issues that led to the original terrorist opportunity remain in place. Poverty. Terrible poverty. No better now than when I was driving through all that area in 1979. Terrible disease. More people dying of malaria than were dying then, even though we've got many more tools and solutions. And an incredible population growth because of the lack of confidence that children will live, the usual problem, but also because of the continuing, absolutely appalling lack of opportunity, both for life chances and choice for women, not least when, whether and how many children to have, and the birth spacing. And so all that leads to this perfect storm of opportunity for people to say, we will receive whatever you're prepared to offer. And that is what, in my opinion, in the light of the Sahel experience, is what those who are organising for terrorism are looking for to give themselves a safe haven platform. Because populations, and this is absolutely true in that part of the world, are well connected. Lots of communications at the moment crossing Niger, going from the sort of northern part. Some are flowing back up to Libya, where I have to say it's not because there were arms coming out of Libya we had this problem. But unquestionably, a lot of groups were emboldened by the fact they suddenly had a huge number of cheaper arms available to them. And now that corridor is open. The southern border of Libya is a concern. There is, of course, a major asset in northern Niger, just north of the corridor, south of the Algerian border, at Arlit. I happened to almost bump into it in 1979, just after it had been built, the uranium mine. And it's obviously very important in terms of an international asset. And then as you go further south, you've got the whole of the Nigerian border, and you've been reading, not just in the last few days, at least in the last few days, about the continuing activities of Boko Haram and Ansarou. And so in a forum, which is an open forum, in the light of experience of what has taken place in Mali, in a recognition that all the conditions that led to that, which are perceived by most of us to belong to an area which we thought was the natural barrier between a sort of West Africa and a North Africa. In fact, that barrier doesn't exist. That is being connected by people, some of whom want to do well and others who would wish to do us ill. There is a growing recognition that the answer to this, and perhaps even the answer to the question whether we have had terror averted, which I think is something which we can at least look back on over the last 12 months, we have averted what was unquestionably a terror platform. But whether it's just postponed, because, of course, there are still plenty of those who were in the original sort of cadres of those groups in northern Mali are still around. They're regrouping. The threat is now probably more asymmetric across that part of the world. But also, we are really struggling with having a functioning regional groupings where borders are often honoured only in the breach, where they're almost impossible to police, thousands and thousands of miles of desert. Speaking to the president of Mauritania the other day, as it happens, IBK was 3 hours late for his own inauguration, so all the presidents sitting along the front row in 41 degrees in the heat. It was quite nice because I hadn't have been travelling around, as you know, in the last 13 months so intensively, I had the chance to talk to all of them. And he did mention the president of Mauritania. He said, well, actually, we don't see our border as a line. Our border increasingly is going to have to be those remote groups who live near our border with Niger or Algeria. We are going to have to say to them, you need to become an extension resource of our government. Because you know who is coming, who is an infiltrator, or not local, as against we don't. And this is true of the discussions I had in Libya, which is not strictly part of the Sahel, but their southern border is unquestionably affected by all the worries of the Sahel. And the Tebu, for instance, control completely the southern borders of part of the southern borders of Libya. So the question for us and for all the local governments, and above all a regional coordination, which I think is the challenge we have to sort of face up to, is how do you make some of those who have not been part of the establishment, part of the power base, part of the vested interests, who felt excluded, who have had the chance to prey upon the vulnerability of very poor people, who are in desperate need for the basic materials of life, how do we make them part of the extension resource of legitimate governments, of good administration, of slowly emerging formal, counted, recognised instruments of legitimate, democratically accountable governance, as against competing for advantage to the exclusion of others, and often in a corrupt way. And on top of all that, there's one final point I would leave, which is, if you like, a sort of tangential point we might want to bring out in discussion, and that is, there's been some suggestion that this area is prey, indeed was driven by what we call narco-terrorism. There are even, and I respect the fact that His Excellency the Ambassador of Algeria is here, this is a phrase you hear a lot in Algeria. What's becoming clear is that the terrorists, particularly Al-Qaeda, they didn't move drugs. And indeed, these drugs are big consignments, huge articulated lorries. I mean, they've got the money to be able to do this stuff. This is not on the back of Toyotas. These are massive, where corruption is the language to get through the borders. And these massive shipments are going through. But the terrorists don't possess them. There are protection fees. There are passage fees. But they don't enter the criminality of the drug transportation. That is for the criminal gangs who have been doing this for millennia. And so I think we need to be extremely careful not to conflate some of the issues about narcotics trade and terrorism. Unquestionably, there will be links, and unquestionably, there is, of course, financial transactions which flow both ways. But to conflate it into this phrase, narco-terrorism, I think could be to aim off too far from the reality on the ground that we actually need to address and to therefore organise ourselves in order to have an appropriate response to a continuing threat, most of which can be averted not by simply having military preparedness and the willingness to use it and the projection of political will, which, if you like, is my appointment by the Prime Minister to show the UK felt it had a real interest, a real stake in the ground in this remote area, which felt too remote to most people, but also because we must focus on good governance, engagement, respect, but equally on the development issues, not just humanitarian response, but good, strong stabilisation and resilience programmes over the long term, which are going to give people hope and jobs and a sense of engagement and justice. That's the best antidote, and that's the best way we can try and play our collective way forward on an international platform. Thank you.